Today is Monday, March 15th, and you are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, President Biden hits the road to sell COVID relief bill.
President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris are traveling as part of a so-called Help Is Here tour.
Also, at least 39 protesters killed in Myanmar.
Security forces killed at least 22 anti-coup protesters in a poor industrial suburb of Myanmar's main city.
Plus, tension rises in Benin ahead of presidential election. These stories and more are next. This week, President Joe Biden hits the road after signing a $1.9 trillion economic stimulus package, and Americans begin to receive stimulus checks. Meanwhile, Washington debates how to handle a surge of migrants arriving at the U.S. southern border. Michelle Quinn reports.
President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris are traveling as part of a so-called Help Is Here tour to promote the $1.9 trillion economic stimulus package he signed into law last week. Touted as one of the most sweeping anti-poverty measures in decades, the package includes $1,400 stimulus checks for many Americans and a new $3,600 per child tax rebate for parents. No Republicans voted for the measure, arguing it was too big and unfocused.
Republicans want to make sure people get shots in the arms, kids get back to school, people get back to work. But we are not going to stand with the Democrats as they try to exploit a crisis.
Democrats point to recent polling that shows a majority of Americans supports the package. A poll by CNN, for example, found that 61% of respondents support the relief measure. House Majority Leader Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat, says the lack of Republican support is just in Washington.
You can be sure that all of their states and communities will be benefiting from this, and they won't be complaining about it back home.
Meanwhile, Washington is at odds over how to handle a surge of migrants at the U.S. southern border. The situation has led to finger-pointing, with some Republicans saying that Biden's rollback of immigration measures implemented by former President Donald Trump are to blame for the surge. Democrats argue that it was Trump's policies that set up the situation today. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
The top U.S. diplomatic and defense officials will arrive in Northeast Asia Monday. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin will hold talks in Japan and South Korea. China and North Korea are expected to be high on the agenda.
The trips to Seoul and Tokyo are the secretary's first overseas travel as envoys of the Biden administration. The officials are in the region to shore up support among America's closest allies as a counterweight to an increasingly assertive China. A White House strategy paper released last week says that Beijing poses the greatest threat to the current international system. But Secretary Blinken and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan are expected to hold talks with China's Foreign Minister Wang Yi and Chief Diplomat Yang Jiechi in Anchorage, Alaska, later in the week. The officials are also expected to look for common ground with allies on how to persuade North Korea to return to the negotiating table. The Biden administration has tried reaching out to Pyongyang, but has received no response, according to multiple media reports. A review of U.S. strategy toward the North is currently underway. Jason Strother for VOA News, Seoul.
Myanmar's ruling junta has declared martial law in six townships in the country's largest city as security forces killed dozens of protesters over the weekend in an increasingly lethal crackdown on resistance to last month's military coup. State broadcaster MRTV said Monday that the Yangon townships of North Dagon, South Dagon, Dagon Saikan, and North Okolapa are under martial law. Local media had reported that at least 39 protesters were killed by security forces, making it the bloodiest day since elected leader Aung San Suu Kyi was overthrown February 1st. Lisa Bernard of Reuters produced this report.
Security forces killed at least 22 anti-coup protesters in a poor industrial suburb of Myanmar's main city after Chinese-financed factories were set ablaze there, according to a human rights group, which also said 16 more protesters were killed in other places, as was one policeman. The Chinese embassy said many Chinese staff were injured and trapped in arson attacks by unidentified assailants on garment factories, and said that it had called on Myanmar to protect Chinese property and citizens. China is viewed as being supportive of the military junta that has taken power. As plumes of smoke rose from the industrial area, security forces opened fire on protesters in the suburb that is home to migrants from across the country, local media said. Martial law was imposed there and in the district of Yangon, Myanmar's commercial hub and former capital, state media announced. A junta spokesman did not answer calls requesting comment. The latest deaths would bring the toll from the protests to 126, according to the human rights group. The army said it took power after its accusations of fraud in a November 8th election won by Suu Kyi's party were rejected by the Electoral Commission. It has promised to hold a new election, but has not set a date. Suu Kyi has been detained since the coup and is due to return to court on Monday. She faces at least four charges, including illegal use of walkie-talkie radios and infringing coronavirus protocols.
That's Lisa Bernhard of Reuters. The Biden administration is reaching out a helping hand to citizens of Myanmar who are currently staying in the United States. AP's Jackie Quinn reports.
In Myanmar, military leaders have overthrown the country's elected government and have used deadly force against protesters. So Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas is offering temporary protected status to people from the Southeast Asian country who are already in the United States. This temporary protection would last for 18 months. Mayorkas says the takeovers worsened humanitarian conditions, disrupted aid flights, and triggered an economic crisis, making it difficult for Myanmar nationals and longtime residents to safely return to their country. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Russian police detained more than 180 people Saturday at a pro-democracy forum. International edition Steve Miller spoke with reporter Charles Maines in Moscow to get the details.
This was a conference or a democracy forum for municipal deputies. So these are local politicians in Russia from opposition parties who've managed to kind of crack through the system and win races in recent years. They were sharing sort of their kind of best practices and some strategies. That was certainly the idea anyway for other prospective candidates who might be running in this fall's election. You know, and you had basically about, I don't know, I want to say 200 maybe participants, maybe, you know, quite a few journalists there to just check it out and see what's going on. And proceedings got underway with their first kind of roundtable discussion, involved the former mayor of Katrinburg, a big city in Russia, a couple of independent deputies. And everything seemed to be going fine, except then about 20 minutes into it, the police stormed the hotel room. This was all in a Moscow hotel, all legitimate, nothing underground here. And they pronounced that the event was closed. It was illegal, that everyone would be arrested, including the speakers and the audience, because it had alleged ties to a so-called undesirable organization. That's part of a group that has some ties to a Russian oligarch who's been exiled and is considered an enemy of the Kremlin. So that basically led to 200 arrests over the day. Quite a remarkable kind of turn of events for what seemed to be, you know, a regular kind of conference situation.
Following these arrests, what's been the reaction throughout the pro-democracy movement within Russia?
Well, I think, you know, the key thing here is that even though there were 200 people that were arrested, they've got some court cases now to face. They weren't held for particularly long, several hours, and then released, but they'll have to go to court. And the question is, what was the purpose of this, right? Was this designed to then keep, perhaps, for example, we've seen in recent years that municipal deputies have made some headway in races against pro-Kremlin parties, particularly the United Russia Party, which is the Kremlin's favorite party. And it seems maybe this was a way to disqualify them from future races this fall. That's just one of the theories kind of batted around the sort of the Kremlin analyst world at this point. I think it is a sense also, if you've got to note that it's happening after the arrest and imprisonment of Alexei Navalny, the opposition leader, who's now in prison for the next 2.5 years on charges of violating his parole obligations from an old case that many people think was trumped up, essentially politically motivated. And so, you know, this, and we've also seen in the wake of protests that happened because of Mr. Navalny's arrest, over 10,000 people arrested here in Russia. So there's really an attempt to kind of intimidate, whether it's on the ballot or on the street.
That's my colleague Steve Miller speaking with Charles Maines in Moscow. You are listening to International Edition and the Voice of America. I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Opposition parties in Benin's April 11th presidential elections are accusing the government of imposing conditions that could undermine the credibility of the process. They say President Patrice Talon's electoral law reform requiring each candidate to be formally sponsored by 60 mayors or members of parliament has disqualified key opponents, while others have gone into exile. The government says the electoral measures are lawful. The Electoral Commission has approved 3 of 20 candidates to face the incumbent. For more on the growing tensions ahead of the polls, I spoke with political analyst Theodore Noachi.
Seeing what is happening now, seeing what rumors are saying, seeing the environment, election environment, it is clear that government should make more effort to make the environment fair, calm.
We're getting reports that there are about 20 candidates contesting for the presidency.
Yeah.
Is that number not too much? Wouldn't that bring confusion?
Really, no. Because we are in open competition, they say that maybe if there is 20, 30, 40 candidates, there is no problem. But because National Electoral Commission, which is there to show that if you put your documents, that agency will show that you are ready, your documents are ready. They permit you to be there. We can't say that it's too much, but that agency said that eliminates 17. Then finally, we can't say that it's too much. It's not too much.
We understand that some opposition figures have been banned from participating in the election, and others are in exile. Will this affect the election being free and fair?
You can say that the election will be fair, because what they didn't do is that the moment they changed the constitution, they should normally put their fingers to say, no, this is not good, this is not good, this is good. They didn't do it. They accepted the constitution. That is not the moment now to protest or saying that, no, what you are doing is not good. On my point of view, they are late from protesting. It's not the moment. And then regarding the document, constitution and election documents, I think that election will be fair. Even if elections are not fair, they will accept it because they didn't protest against the documents of the elections.
What is the general feeling among the Beninois? Are they looking forward to it?
I'm not too sure people will get out for the vote because they are fearing that those of opposition parties who make violence, and because we see soldiers and policemen everywhere, then people were scared that maybe they will shoot them, and they are not sure they will be out for the votes. Or even if they accepted to be out, to get out for the votes, they will not be an important people.
The current president, how would you rate his performance? Has he done a good job in improving the lives of the people and also the security of the people?
I don't know if you know Cotonou. You knew Cotonou before. If you knew Cotonou before, you call now in Cotonou. Seeing our roads, you'll be happy of the image of Cotonou and some of our towns. But on the social way, economic way, that is things to improve. It's not a starvation, but people before they ate 3 times, some now eat 2 times a day.
That's political analyst and law lecturer Theodore Noachi speaking with me from Cotonou, Benin. Western countries on Friday called on Egypt to end the prosecution of activists, journalists, and perceived political opponents under counterterrorism laws and to unconditionally release them. The United States joined 30 members of the UN Human Rights Council in signing the joint statement on Egypt, the first since 2014, which called on the government to lift curbs on freedom of expression and assembly. Egypt rejects the criticism and asked its representative to deliver a statement before the Human Rights Council to shed light on the human rights violations within these countries that issued the joint statement. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, Egypt has imprisoned 27 journalists and became the worst jail of journalists in the Middle East and North Africa, and the world's third largest jail of journalists after China and Turkey. Sherif Mansour, MENA program coordinator at CPJ, explained the situation to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
This is by far the worst time to be a journalist in Egypt's modern history. We at the Committee to Protect Journalists have been documented since 2013 when President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi took over. Egypt has consistently been one of the worst jailers of journalists and the worst in the Middle East region, and in many ways represent what the concentrated strategy of Abdel Fattah al-Sisi's government to roll back fear barrier and criminalize legitimate journalism. And at least over the last 5 years, it's been permitted largely by the scant criticism his government has received from U.S. and Western allies.
The report said that Egypt leads the world in jailing journalists on false news charges, and when a journalist is released in Egypt, he or she is not completely free because release conditions and probation conditions make it impossible for journalists to resume work in journalism again. What prompted the Egyptian government to resort to such tactics?
The government have engaged in politically motivated trials, bringing together journalists, activists, academics, holding them without trial for the purpose of punishing them outside the law. These kind of arbitrary detentions makes journalists think twice before daring to question the government line. And the fact that they are released but not free keeps them under the government thumb. Sometimes the probation condition would require journalists like Shawkan, a photojournalist and award-winning photographer, to go every night to spend 12 hours in prison. Or even, again, someone like Mahmoud Hussein, Al Jazeera journalist, who was released after more than 4 years in custody, has to appear twice in front of a police officer as part of his probation. These and other forms of legal threats and bans, including barring from international travel against Madam Asr investigative journalist Hossam Bahga, are all constant reminders of journalists never to cross red line and to be subjected to censorship at every turn.
According to the CPJ report, most imprisoned journalists in Egypt are charged but not sentenced. They are detained for months or years, awaiting trial on false news and terrorism charges. How would you explain the harsh response to opposing views and opinions in Egypt?
Using vague terrorism and false news charges are in part ways to expand the government censorship strategy to keep President al-Sisi in power without accountability and without much criticism. And in these cases, cruelty is the goal, for journalists to feel helpless, to accept the least possible outcome. And the use of counterterrorism and false news is also accompanied by rhetoric by government officials headed by President Sisi himself, who tried to delegitimize journalists and to describe them as quote-unquote forces of evil to justify the use of excessive emergency and military law to deny them any pretense of rule of law or justice under the law.
That's Sheriff Mansour, MENA Programs Coordinator at CPJ, speaking with my colleague, Mohamed El-Shanawi. Australia is working on an ambitious plan to establish Singapore as a COVID-19 quarantine gateway and potential vaccination hub for returning Australians, international students, and business travellers. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The deal with Singapore could allow passengers en route to Australia to satisfy strict biosecurity rules before arrival. Ministers hope the proposal with the Southeast Asian city would help about 40,000 Australians stranded overseas return home, boost tourism, and revive the multi-billion dollar market for international students at Australian universities, which has been badly hit by border closures. It's a year since Canberra, Australia's capital, barred most foreign travellers in an attempt to curb the spread of COVID-19. The ban has recently been extended until at least June. Australian Deputy Prime Minister Michael McCormack says the government is preparing to restart international travel.
We're also making sure that the planes are going to be ready. You can't just roll a plane out of a hangar and stick it back on an international route. We're working with Singapore at the moment, potentially for a bubble in July. And these are positive signs. And as the vaccine rolls out, in not only in Australia but in other countries as well, we'll reopen more bubbles.
Under the plan, Australians would be allowed to fly to Singapore without government approval, provided they've been vaccinated against COVID-19. Also, Singaporeans who've been inoculated would be permitted to travel to Australia without having to undergo 2 weeks of hotel quarantine. Australia has given travellers from New Zealand similar concessions, but authorities in Wellington have yet to reciprocate to allow entry to Australians. Australian citizens can return home from overseas, but they face mandatory quarantine. Thousands of people have been left stranded because of limited capacity in secure hotels. Australia has recorded just over 29,000 COVID-19 cases since the pandemic began. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The 63rd Grammy Awards were held Sunday night. For highlights and a look at how African artists fared, VOA's Jason Potankin speaks with Justin Vunganyi, host of VOA's Upfront Africa and Red Carpet Shows.
Jackson, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. So starting off, what were some of the highlights of last night's Grammy Awards?
Jason, after a little over a year of virtual awards shows due to the pandemic, the 2021 Grammy Awards were very intentional in providing a hopeful glimpse in, you know, what that post-pandemic world of award shows will most likely look like. You know, it was outdoorsy, fun, socially distanced, but most importantly, COVID-free, at least for 2021. Now, there's hope in the entertainment industry that things will start getting back to, you know, those pre-COVID days very soon. Now, some of the highlights, let's start with Beyoncé, also known as Queen B. She made history. She's now the first female artist with the most Grammys. She won her 28th Grammy yesterday. Rap legend Nas, he won Best Rap Album, his first ever Grammy Award, believe it or not. He was first nominated in 1996. So many highlights. It was such a fun show to watch, a little long, but, you know, these are the times that we live in. The people who won were more diverse this time around than, you know, previously. So, yeah.
And there were some African winners this year. What can you tell us about them? How did the continents do last night?
The continent, the African continent, was very well represented by two Afrobeat heavyweights, both from Nigeria, Burna Boy and Wizkid. Burna Boy won the Best Global Music Album category for his fourth album, Twice as Tall. Now, this is a category that was formerly known as Best World Music Album, you know, as a way of trying to acknowledge this, you know, endless trove of music that lies outside of the mainstream of the United States. Anyways, this is the second year in a row that Burna Boy was nominated. And Wizkid won Best Music Video for his song with Beyoncé, Brown Skin Girl, from the album Lion King, The Gift. That's the soundtrack to the Lion King movie.
And, of course, South African comedian Trevor Noah hosted the event. How'd he do?
He did great. Like I said, he did great. He was phenomenal. You know, the Recording Academy, which puts on these Grammy Awards, has consistently, over the years, faced controversy because of what they say, its lack of diversity, whether it was in its membership, its nominations, and the awards that were given out. And I think that for them, booking Trevor Noah to host the event was probably an attempt to try and reflect this new progressive institution that is taking these criticisms to heart and working to repair their image. And if this was the year of new beginnings, then this was a great start.
New beginnings. I think that's something almost everyone can support this year. Thank you so much for joining us, Jackson.
Thank you, Jason.
That's my colleague, Jason Potankin, speaking with Jackson Vunganyi, host of VOA's Upfront Africa and Red Carpet Shows. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Gene Edwards in Washington.